Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A tie-breaking vote from Vice President Mike Pence yesterday launched the Senate debate over the Republican goal to repeal and replace Obamacare. Senator John McCain of Arizona returned to Washington after recent brain surgery and a diagnosis of brain cancer to support the measure. But he took to the floor after the vote to appeal to his colleagues for bipartisanship.
We're getting nothing done, my friends. We're getting nothing done. And all we've really done this year is confirm Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. Our health care insurance system is a mess. We all know it. Those who support Obamacare and those who oppose it. Something has to be done.
Although Republicans couldn't muster the necessary 60 votes to actually pass the repeal yesterday, they're expected to vote today on another proposal that would put the kibosh on Obamacare. Then there's Russia and Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the new White House Director of Communications, Anthony Scaramucci. I just like to say his name, and transgender in the military. Joining us is Ohio State University political scientist Paul Beck. Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Ann.
Also by phone, Columbus Dispatch Washington correspondent Jessica Wehrman. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time, Jessica, especially to join us. Usually summer's kind of slowed down by now, but not this summer.
Yeah, you know, the phrase drinking water from a fire hose is sort of, you know, keeps coming into my head. It's been pretty busy, but, you know. Never boring.
Lots to talk about. The Senate votes today on another measure to repeal Obamacare. What's the difference between the bill that they rejected yesterday and what they will consider today?
Okay, so let me walk you through sort of the steps here. The first thing that they voted on, that was a very big dramatic vote, which we can talk about later, was the motion to proceed, which is basically it was a motion to not adopt, but to take up the House passed version of the bill, which passed in May, and amend it. They then moved on to the most recent Senate version. They call it BICRA, but I don't like all these, you know, these alphabet soup. It's the Senate the latest Senate version to sort of dismantle the 2010 health care bill known as Obamacare. It also had two amendments in it, one by Ted Cruz, which would sort of allow exchanges to sell sort of more bare-bones, stripped-down policies. And it also included one by Senator Rob Portman of Ohio that would include $100 billion to help those who were transitioning off of the Medicaid expansion that that Obamacare included. So basically try to keep the deductibles and out-of-pocket costs down for them. They took that up around 10 p.m. last night. It was sort of all a piece. They lumped it all together. And what they did was they sort of refused to kind of move forward with that particular bill. So on to the next thing. And what is the next thing? It is basically repealing the bill like they voted to do in 2015 and then sort of delaying the repeal so it wouldn't automatically go away, but it would take 2 years for it to go away, giving them 2 years to, I guess, come up with a replacement plan. So that's going to be voted on about 11:30. And then my guess is it won't get the 60 votes necessary, and so then it's on to the next thing. And I'm not really sure what the end. I'm not really sure what the end game is.
You're saying it's not expected to get the 60 votes it needs.
No. I mean, it did in 2015, but a lot has changed then. When senators voted for this, including Senator Portman back in 2015, they all knew Obama was going to veto it. Since then, people are very concerned about the impact and the possibility of taking this away with this sort of deadline of 2 years to come up with something else. The Senate and the House. Spoiler alert, it's not really very good at meeting deadlines. I mean, they try to hit them at the very end, but when they put these sort of self-imposed, like, you have until now to create a new law, it just doesn't usually work out very well. I can get totally nerdy and wonky with you about sort of incidents where this has happened, but I'll spare you that.
Well, it sounds like that's what John McCain is saying. That's just not a good way to make legislation. Paul Beck, there's this self-imposed, they had to do something, so they voted for this repeal, which wouldn't take effect for 2 years, ostensibly to give them time to come up with a replacement. But why was it so important for lawmakers to go back with that under their belts?
Well, I think they have a variety of proposals that they're going to consider, but they're considering them in the open on the floor with the possibility of amendments. What Senator McCain was talking about yesterday and has talked about for the last couple of weeks is returning to what's called regular order. which is the way the Senate normally does business.
Used to do business.
It'll go. That's right. Used to do business. Well, it may be doing business on other issues, but not this one. It goes to committees. Committees hold hearings. Everybody who has a stake in the legislation comes to testify. They then report it out that it goes to the floor eventually for a vote. That's not happening here. And I think it's not happening because Senator McConnell has calculated that he is very close to not having the votes he needs on anything. And so if there's that kind of disagreement, they don't want to open the process up, both to Democratic involvement, but also to kind of nitpicking from individual Republican senators in the hearings process.
They can't. I mean, I keep going back to that movie. I can't remember, but it, where it's like you can't handle the truth. That line.
Oh wait,
I mean, why is the Senate avoiding open debate on the issue of health care? Even the Democrats, who again passed it without any Republican help back in the day, did committee hearings on it for months.
You know, when you get in the majority of the Senate or the House, you think, hot dog, I get a chance to really weigh in on policy because I'm in the majority. What my party votes for is typically going to become law, though that's a little harder in the Senate. A lot of times there's the requirement for 60 votes. I have found what's very interesting is how many Republicans, including some of the most conservative Republicans, some of the most moderate Republicans in the Senate, are increasingly publicly expressing their dismay and disgust with how this process is being handled. Portman hasn't been outright, I mean, he hasn't been sort of, you know, as outright, but when he was asked, are you part of this group that's figuring out what's going to be in this health care bill, he said no. He really didn't know what was in the bill. This was a couple of weeks ago. Mike Lee, who is sort of a Freedom Caucus-ish sort of very conservative member, was apparently on a plane the other day tweeting his disgust with this. They do not feel like they have a stake in this. They don't feel like they've been at the table. And I think you can't really understate the importance of not feeling like you've had a say in the decision-making process. I mean, my gosh, you can kind of expect this if you're the minority, but if you're the majority and you're not getting a say, well, that's very unusual.
I just figured that the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, was talking to his members about why they're doing it this way and why they're proceeding in this fashion. But that apparently isn't necessarily the case.
I think it is safe to say that many of the Republican members of the Senate feel a little bit left in the dark about how this is going down. I don't think many of them came to the floor yesterday entirely sure of what was going to be in the proposals that they were voting on.
Nor did they leave entirely sure.
Nor did they leave. Basically, what they voted for yesterday was, let's get this party started. But they don't really know what's going to be at the party, what are the apps, what's being served to drink.
Well, I would add to this that there's this cloak of uncertainty there as to the effects of anything they pass. And I think we really don't know what's going to happen. Will the insurance markets just implode?
Yeah.
If they pass a bill that really, for the insurance carriers, doesn't really seem to make sense? Will there be millions and millions of people, you know, 21, 22 million to 30-some million, who are left without insurance? What does that mean?
Anyway.
And then there's the issue, and I've always felt that the attack on Obamacare and the attempt to reform and repeal Obamacare is only part of this story. The other part of the story is that for a long time, Republicans have wanted to dismantle Medicaid, period, even before Obamacare.
Right.
They wanted to do that. And they're doing it by, I think, what I would call kind of a cynical maneuver, and that is to simply pull federal funding over time increasingly from the payments that go to the states, and then force the states, all of which, of course, have to have balanced budgets, or 49 of 50 have to have balanced budgets, force the states to do the hard medicine, to be the ones that decide how they are going to cut Medicaid or fund it themselves, which they really don't have the finances to do. And so it's this dual assault here, one on Obamacare that gets the headlines. The second one kind of underlying this, and that is a deep-seated conservative and Republican aversion to Medicaid itself.
Jessica Weirman, though, your thoughts on that? And also, is this just bad timing for the Republicans because we also have an opioid crisis that absolutely depends on Medicaid funding at this point?
We do, and that's made this a very, very uncomfortable vote for folks in states that are particularly impacted, for Senator Portman, for Shelley Moore Capito in West Virginia, which has also been particularly hard hit. This, I'm trying to remember the statistics, so forgive me if this is a little bit off, but I was at a hearing on the opioid crisis where they talked about 40% of opioid addicts use Medicaid for some of their treatment options. This is a huge tool in the war chest, I guess, or in the toolbox against the opioid crisis. So this is a very uncomfortable vote. And in fact, the only one of the big reasons that I think Senator Portman did agree on the motion to proceed yesterday was because he managed to secure a promise that they would support this newest version of the bill, included $45 billion for the opioid treatment. That's still nowhere near the $850 billion that the Medicaid expansion covers. As for the future of Medicaid itself, I think there's sort of a larger movement to sort of block grant it, to cap the amount that you can.
But once you block grant it, then you can start to shave it.
Yes, you can. And that's been a very big concern among those who rely on it. Now, remember, Medicaid, the expansion sort of changed things, but Medicaid traditionally has served two groups, old people and little kids. And so this is it's going to be subject to criticism. Any sort of attempt to block grant is going to be subject to huge criticism, as well as concerns that it's not going to meet the needs. I mean, these are means-tested programs, so in theory, if you don't have the means, you get the program. Now, that becomes a lot more difficult when there's a cap on the amount, you know, that the state, how do you meet that need? Other programs that serve the poor that are means-tested that have been block granted, you get a lot of complaints that, you know, if you're eligible for affordable housing, there's still these huge lists because there's a cap on this. So, you know, putting this on Medicaid would have a very, very, a very strong impact on the group of folks who actually traditionally benefit from Medicaid. And these are the poorest of the poor traditionally. Medicaid expansion has changed that, but take away Medicaid expansion, just block grant the basic program, and these are very, very poor people.
There was a New York Times story, I believe, might have been Washington Post, I apologize, about, and I think it was in one of the states that did not expand Medicaid, where people are starting to line up at 2 o'clock in the morning for a free clinic, and they in one day that served about 2,000 or 3,000 people.
I think that's Virginia.
Virginia,
yeah.
Right? That's it. It's a real thing out there. By the way, the movie "You Can't Handle the Truth" line came from is a Few Good Men. Thank you.
I knew. Right on the edge of my tongue.
Yeah, I know, me too. My intrepid producer, Michael DeBonis, gets credit for that one. John McCain isn't the first to cast a deciding vote on health care while sick with cancer. Ted Kennedy did the same thing before he died of the same kind of brain cancer in 2009, but he voted for Obamacare. The irony of McCain's diagnosis and the fact that he can afford the best care anyway, the most expensive treatments to prolong his life, isn't lost on a lot of people. What's the politics of that, Jessica Werman?
A lot of times with these procedural votes, Republican members who may be uncomfortable about the larger legislation will say, you know what, we need to have a debate on this. We need to get this on the floor. And I think that was part of the rationale. Now, mind you, what I was a little bit surprised by was, afterwards, you'll remember he made this long speech about we all need to work together, and I wouldn't vote for this bill as it stands. But he also later on did a second procedural vote that night that would have moved forward with a bill that he did, you know, he said, the bill that he said would not, he wouldn't vote for at this point. Am I making sense here? I mean, basically what I'm saying is that I don't like the bill, but then later on that night.
He voted for it.
Yes.
He essentially voted for the bill. So I'm a little bit.
Well, so did Rob Portman.
That also included $100 billion that he secured for it. So, I mean, he may not have liked the sort of base bill, but it included $100 billion for a group he was very concerned about. So,
yeah, the what do they call it? The optics of that, Paul Beck.
Well, I think the optics of this in general, as it drags out over time, and as there are a number of votes on things that the public is really not going to understand very well, plus the cry that nobody knows what's in the bills, the optics are very harmful, I think, to the Republicans. And I think they're beginning to realize this. And, of course, they're under pressure now from the White House to pass something. And that is a difficulty for them as well. What they want to do is, of course, support their leadership strategy in moving this forward. And that's, I think, what we saw in that first procedural vote. But in the end, they've got to vote for legislation that, if it passes, is going to have really severe consequences for the healthcare system in general. And then there's this uncertainty as to exactly what those consequences are going to be and how it will play out in their own states.
You know, until just a moment ago, we had spent the entire segment and didn't mention the White House. So it's another topic for another segment coming up. If you have a question or comment, we're kind of trying to cover the waterfront, but focusing a lot on, of course, healthcare this hour. If you have a question or comment for my guests, Jessica Wehrman of the Columbus Dispatch in Washington, and also Paul Beck, political scientist at OSU, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about national politics this hour. President Trump last night traveled to Youngstown, where he attracted a crowd of about 8,000 to a rally intended as a morale boost. Among other things, he lauded the Senate vote to proceed with debate on the plan to repeal and replace Obamacare.
We're now one step closer to liberating our citizens from this Obamacare nightmare. And delivering great health care for the American people.
Still with us is Ohio State University political scientist Paul Beck, and by phone, Columbus Dispatch Washington correspondent Jessica Wehrman. Question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jessica, before we move on to talking about President Trump, Ohio Senator Rob Portman voted for both bills yesterday, as we just talked about both the motion to proceed and also this first version, which included $100 billion for Medicaid expansion.
Medicaid expansion, yeah.
Right. And the first bill, the motion to proceed, succeeded. The second bill did not get the needed 60 votes. Be that as it may, I read one analysis that the national media has made him out to be a moderate. This is Rob Portman, when he is clearly a conservative. And I was wondering, what do you make of the perceptions of Rob Portman and the heightened awareness of Americans of his existence? I mean, he's not exactly a loudmouth, but he gets a lot of coverage.
So he's, if you were to call him moderate in anything, I think it would be demeanor. I mean, he's not going to go out there and browbeat or scream or yell or beat his chest or whatever. I mean, he's a sort of kind of low-key sort of person to talk to. Now, he is conservative politically. He is, I mean, we cannot understate that. But I think the reason that he's been really people have had their eye on him in this particular thing debate has been because he represents a swing state. And he not only does he represent a swing state, but he represents a swing state where he won re-election in part last year by promising to help bring an end to the opioid epidemic, which, I mean, there are more. I think the statistic I read this morning is more people die of opioid overdoses in Ohio than car crashes.
Right.
So this is a huge epidemic in the state. He campaigned saying he's going to bring, and he has passed or push bills that have helped to pay for opioid treatment, prevention, treatment, awareness, that sort of thing. So this is a huge issue. The Medicaid issue is a huge one for him, because if opioid addicts in Ohio lose one of the key ways that they receive treatment, then that's not going to help solve this problem. So traditionally, you can expect him to be, you know, rock rib conservative. In fact, he votes 95.5% of the time with President Trump, according to an analysis I read yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But he's moderate in demeanor, and this is an issue that has an impact on his state, and that's why he's in the limelight.
He also, of course, is a critical vote for the Republicans.
Yes.
And when they're teetering around 50 votes, any loss of the Republican side of a vote is going to scuttle whatever legislation is being voted on there.
Yeah, if you're looking for somebody, if you're like putting money on who's the person who's going to kind of maybe buck the party, I'd put it on like Susan Collins, Murkowski, maybe Capito on this issue, but not necessarily. But yeah, but he's a little bit of a safer vote for the Republicans, the Republican leadership.
Let's take a call from Ricardo in Lancaster. You're on the air. Hi, Ricardo.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is, first of all, I will say I am a physician for the last 40 years and practicing in a couple of states. And I am baffled by the fact that nobody wants to talk about universal health care. We are playing politics with health policy, but we don't want to address the problem in a way that is going to be better for the entire nation. Currently, I know there are various groups that have interest in maintaining the system the way it is, but we have to change because the country cannot afford to continue on this path. There's just not enough money for an industry or an area of the economy that covers about, I believe, about a sixth, one-sixth of our economy. Hmm. Insurance companies are making money from health care. Pharmaceutical companies are making tons of money from health care. Physicians are well paid. I'm one of them. Patients expect the system to pay for every little thing until we are 120 years old. That cannot happen. It is impossible. It is unsustainable. So why are our politicians and our press and our public not discussing things in a more rational way? We cannot afford this. Let's come up with a system where everybody puts in a bid so we can make this sustainable.
Paul Beck?
You know, the disappointment for me really comes along the lines that Ricardo has talked about, and that is that there is a problem in terms of the costs of health care and accessibility to health care. It's a problem that you would expect both parties to want to try to come together to address. Medicaid, for example, is a program that is more and more costly over time. There needs to be some way found to try to rein in the increasing costs. And this is true in the private industry as well in terms of medical insurance. Everybody is facing these increasing cost problems. What's going on in the Senate and the House right now is not addressing that at all. The feeling on the part, I think, of the Republican majorities is the way you address the cost is simply to stop the government from covering certain areas of health care, particularly for people who don't have the money to pay for it themselves. That's a very short-sighted strategy, and it doesn't take that problem off the table. So it you know, one wishes that there wasn't such partisan polarization in Washington and maybe in the country more broadly, that we could deal with these issues in a way that gets kind of bipartisan agreement to work out some kind of a long-term solution.
Jessica Wehrman?
I mean, I think there are folks who are have discussed particularly in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, a single payer. There's been discussion of universal care in some sections, but that hasn't been taken seriously. There's a real fundamental disagreement about what drives down costs among healthcare. Among some Republicans, they would say, you know, we're really providing far too much. These, you know, that's where you get the argument of, I'm a man, why do I need to pay for maternity leave? But the other end of it is, if you have a very large pool of people healthy and sick, that drives down the costs for everybody because the healthy people don't have to, they don't cost as much, and you know, they can kind of help pay for the sick because you have this vast pool of people. So in many, you know, many hands make light work, sort of like that metaphor except used towards cost. So there's a real fundamental disagreement about what would drive down costs, and I think we can't even get past that to get to the issue of universal. Now, we got a little bit closer to covering people with the Medicaid expansion, but that was clearly a very unpopular idea among some.
You know, there's another fundamental issue besides how the costs are figured when it comes to health care, and that's about whether or not there is a right to health care in this country. We know there's a right in other countries. They've made it very, very clear. But I heard a caller call in on Point, you know, an NPR show the other day, very nicely spoken, nice, rational sounding kind of guy, say that, "I'm sorry, but I don't think it's a right. If you can't afford it, it's just too bad for you. But I shouldn't have to pay for it." Do they ever get down to that kind of level of talking about whether it's a right or not, Jessica?
That's not really a discussion that's been very prominent in this particular debate. It's more of how do we sort of tackle the healthcare industry and costs as a whole. But no, the question of whether it's a right, I've really not heard that much, particularly not among my own lawmakers, which is obviously my particular focus group.
I think one reason that they're not saying that, at least in political circles, is that one of the effects of Obamacare, like it or not, is that it established for a majority of Americans a right to medical care. And we can't go back from that. There's now an expectation there that is held by a sizable majority of people, which wasn't there before. You know, 10 years ago, it necessarily wasn't there, but I think it's there now. And the other point that I would make is an interesting one, I think, and that is that all other major industrialized countries in this world have a form of health care that is more or less universal, but they do it in a whole variety of different ways. Some of them through employers, some of them through holding down the cost with government employees.
As far as administering it.
Exactly. And so there are all kinds of models out there that we could look at as policymakers and try to kind of pick and choose what we think is a better model for us. But that really isn't the focus right now, unfortunately.
Let's turn to another issue. Britt in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Britt.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. This is a great show.
Thank you.
I had a question. You were talking about Rob Portman being a conservative earlier. I had a question with regards to the relationship between Governor Kasich and Rob Portman, because even though they're both Republicans, it seems like Kasich would be more moderate as far as – I wouldn't say he would support the Obamacare, but he doesn't seem to be as big on repealing or replacing it.
Well, it's the Medicaid, the expansion that he supports the most, Britt. But Jessica Wehrman, in your article today that you co-wrote with Jack Tory, there was reference to the fact that Rob Portman did call Governor Kasich to let him know how he was going to vote on that repeal bill yesterday.
He did. He gave him a heads up about where he was going with it. And I believe that they have had conversations. I mean, beyond that, I believe they've had other conversations. When I asked Kasich about this a couple weeks back, he sort of made a point of saying, listen, I can't influence. He knows where I stand. That's kind of what he needs to know. And beyond that, this is sort of his decision. He's in the Senate and I'm not. So, but yeah, this is, I mean, I think they both fundamentally are concerned about the impact on the Medicaid population, but Kasich has been a far more openly critical where, for example, with the most recent version of the Senate bill, Portman hasn't said he was, never said he opposed that very most recent version. What he did say was he had some concerns and he just sort of withheld support. And that's actually been kind of what he's done a lot of the time is sort of, well, I'm not really sure where I'm at until sort of the very end. So with Kasich, it's been a little bit more black and white. Portman, you see a little bit more, it's a little bit more unpredictable where he's going to go.
So what is the relationship like? Why would Portman do that, call the governor and let him know, give him a heads up?
Well, because he's the governor of the state. I mean, he oversees the Medicaid population. He does have, you know, he has a vested interest in how this all turns out. So I think that's a courtesy, and I think that's a courtesy you'd see among lawmakers traditionally of sort of the, you know, that role in the states, in their particular states.
There's also an important difference in the roles that they play.
Yes,
a governor is responsible for what happens in his or her state, and it's not a surprise that most governors in this country don't want the Medicaid expansion to end. And they have lobbied against the Senate bill and the House bill as well. whereas people who are in Congress are in a way freer of that responsibility, at least in the here and now. Now, they may reap the scorn or the criticism for what they've done later on, but they aren't responsible for governing day by day.
Britt, thanks a lot for that call. So let's turn now to pure politics and ask Jessica Wehrman why the Youngstown rally, the rally in the valley, they called it, why the Youngstown rally now?
I think that he enjoys making sure that his base is in touch with him. And there is, let me clarify something. President Trump says he won Youngstown.
Right.
He did not.
Right.
What he did do was put a huge, huge dent in what has been traditionally a very Democratic-heavy part of the state. The neighboring counties he did win, did not win Mahoning County. Clinton just she eked out a tiny win there.
A 3%, I think, margin.
They were both like 49, 47, something like that. So anyway, so let's start with that. He enjoys going to these political rallies. I think he really enjoyed the campaigning aspect of, of the political race. He likes to have the big crowds, the big cheering crowds. There was not really a policy aspect of what he did. It wasn't like, the vote was sort of had occurred already. I don't know that that would have influenced him. Going to Youngstown would have influenced Portman's vote particularly. I think it was more of a, let's go out there, let's get in touch with the base, let's make sure they still, they're still my base. So I don't know that there was any sort of particular policy reason for him to go out.
Paul Beck, any significance regarding his brand of presidential visits, the way he does this? It used to be, we're familiar with the, you go visit a company or you go visit a research facility or you go visit a children's program somewhere or whatever. It's policy related, like Jessica said. This is absolutely nothing like that at all.
Well, I think in recent times with the Trump administration, you can see that he draws energy in a very difficult period for him. Obviously, he is under assault with the various investigations that are going on. With the attack on Sessions, he's kind of under assault from the conservative community. And so he goes out to his base at these rallies where you can see from the synergy between the two of them that he really is deriving great energy. And a lot of ad-libbing goes on at these rallies.
Like he used to do kind of earlier in the campaign thing. Yeah.
Exactly. He loves this and he feels like he benefits personally from doing this. Whether he benefits politically, we'll see.
He is really most comfortable, I think, when he's contacting the people directly, be it via a rally like this or via Twitter. I mean, he doesn't really enjoy having the layers between him. And he enjoys this sort of, he really enjoys this sort of politicking as opposed to sitting in a meeting and, I guess ironing out issues of policy. I don't know that he's a policy wonk. I think that's safe to say.
Yes.
All right. We will continue our conversation. It's Jessica Wehrman, Columbus Dispatch Washington correspondent, also with me, Paul Beck, OSU political scientist. If you have a question or comment, we're going to continue on to the issues of politics in the Trump administration and move on to his criticism of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Number is 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the state and national politics this hour. Before heading to Youngstown yesterday, President Trump continued with his criticism of Attorney General Jeff Sessions during a White House press conference.
I am disappointed in the Attorney General. He should not have recused himself almost immediately after he took office. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me prior to taking office, and I would have quite simply pick somebody else. So I think that's a bad thing, not for the president, but for the presidency. I think it's unfair to the presidency.
The president has been criticized for turning on one of his strongest supporters during the campaign. That is Jeff Sessions. So with us is OSU political scientist Paul Beck, and by phone, Columbus Dispatch Washington correspondent Jessica Wehrman. Jeff Sessions, Jessica, you know, was out there, you know, full front and center all through the campaign.
Guy beyond Trump to don that Make America Great hat. So,
right.
So to watch this sort of unfurl has been kind of, it's been kind of a fascinating study, and I don't know if I want to say loyalty, but a fascinating study in how a relationship can deteriorate. And Sessions, too, to Trump made one fatal flaw, which was that he recused himself. He would have preferred he not recuse himself. Now, the other part of this is he does not like having an independent counsel investigating him. And if he gets rid of Sessions, maybe it gets easier for him to get rid of Mueller. But what has been interesting is that this has been sort of the rare case where Senate Republicans are sort of unified in saying, do not fire this guy. Portman sent out a statement yesterday calling Sessions a friend, saying he believes in the rule of law. And he has the best interest of the country at heart. Ken Blackwell, who is actually currently serving the Presidential Election Commission and is about as much of a Trump loyalist as there can really be within the Ohio Republican Party, sent out a statement in favor of Sessions. Sessions is beloved by conservatives. So if Trump should fire him, this would be an incredibly controversial move. Now, that said, I keep reading these articles about how Trump doesn't really like to fire people. Instead, what he really actually likes to do is sort of see them twist in the wind until
right.
They kind of go, yeah, I'm out. And we see no indication that Sessions is deciding to step down. So this is a really fascinating relationship to watch. And I'm not sure how it ends. I'm just going to kind of keep an eye on it. But the loyalty among Republicans sort of would say that this is – if he would actually fire Sessions, it would be an incredibly controversial move. I don't know what it would behoove for his future either, for Trump's.
Right. Well, the Senate could block an appointee, couldn't he?
Could say, we don't want, you know, whoever you decide to replace them, we don't want. Now, I don't know if they go that far. I'm not really sure what happens should he, you know, what the next steps or what dominoes fall next. I just know that they have been pretty much as resoundingly unified as they can be and saying, don't do this. This would be a mistake.
Let me take this in a somewhat related way, and that is that it sends a very chilling signal to Republicans who have been loyal to the Trump administration.
Mm. Yes.
And that is, despite your loyalty to him, he in the end is not necessarily going to be loyal to you. And Sessions was as loyal to the Trump presidency and the campaign before that as any member of the U.S. Congress, certainly any member of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And yet for Trump to kind of turn on him in this way, and even if he doesn't fire him, to kind of let him twist in the wind, basically
is humiliate him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And humiliate him and as a product of Trump's own commentary.
Right.
Not anything else. I think if I were a Republican senator or member of the House, I would think this could be me.
Well,
if I get on his wrong side in one way
Susan
or another.
Ask Susan Collins. I think he publicly called, is it Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski, that he publicly called out in a tweet for voting against the repeal bill yesterday.
Mm-hmm. And Heller, who he said, oh, yeah, he wants to stay in the Senate, doesn't he, during a White House meeting? I mean, that's fairly threatening.
Yes.
But not only that, people such as Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows. Now, remember when this was in the House, they were kind of leading some opposition because they wanted to drive the bill a little further to the right.
Right.
And he was blasting them on Twitter. You know, he ebbs and flows, let's put it that way.
Which has been a problem for his communications team.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to segue to that.
Yeah, Sean Spicer, he was pretty loyal. I mean, he got up and said it was the biggest crowd ever at inauguration, and well.
Yeah, and look where he is now, on his way out in just a matter of days. Anthony Scaramucci, I love saying his name.
I knew you wanted to do that. You wanted to say his name.
yeah, any chance I get. And but he's now, okay, they had the warm and fuzzies a few days ago or last week when he was appointed and he had the press conference with the press corps there in the West Wing. And then yesterday he's come out and said, we will burn, slash and burn this entire staff if we have to get to the leakers.
Yeah, it's a hard place to be employed is the sense that I get.
By the way, what we should not lose sight of is the frenetic pace of all of this.
Yeah. Which is why I'm having this show.
Drumbeat day after day after day.
Yeah.
I picked up the Dispatch this morning and was reading the front section. And I think about half the stories are related to the Trump presidency or health care. And that's really unusual. And we've had this day after day after day after day after day. Just as viewers get tired of some of the drama of some of these TV shows over time, you know, the ones that are really excessively dramatic and violent, one thinks that the public may get tired of hearing this over a period of time.
I do wonder. I think that there were a lot of people who voted for President Trump back in November because they wanted somebody who – they wanted a disruptor. They thought that Washington – and they thought – and they knew Washington wasn't working. And so they thought by electing him, he would kind of – not blow up the place, but he would really sort of bring it down in terms of, you know, whatever was working. He would sort of start it over again, you know, kind of shock it, tase it into something maybe more effective. Mm-hmm. But you have to wonder months later if this is what they had in mind.
But his base seems to be still there for him.
They do, but I think there are some concerns about sort of the daily. It really depends on who you talk to in the base. Some say, you know, this guy's fascinating. People are out to get him. This is a problem. But I think others go, well, we do want a disruptor. We want to overhaul the system, but maybe this isn't the way we wanted to do it.
Well, and the base has had two parts to it, it seems to me. One part was people who have been with Trump all along and who sustained his candidacy when he was running for the Republican nomination. And that was about 40 to 45% of Republicans.
Yeah.
And then there was an add-on to that in the general election, and that was Republicans came home despite what they thought about Trump. And so 89% of Republicans ended up voting for Trump. Part of it was they didn't like Hillary Clinton. They saw that the choice between Trump and Clinton was more favorable to Trump, even if they didn't like him all that well. Now, that group is beginning to peel away. How much it peels away, I think, is yet to be determined. I think that base group that really liked the disruptor that Trump was, that really harbored this deep resentment to what was going on in Washington and how Washington wasn't serving them. And,
well,
and
justifiably,
one can understand
it
that.
It isn't.
Exactly.
I remember driving around Ohio driving around the Youngstown area during the campaign and going, well, of course they're going to vote. These folks are going to vote for Trump because this area, this region is not like it was boarded up shops, boarded up everything.
Yes.
It wasn't a place where you saw a lot of opportunity. Of course you would. Of course you would vote for something different. So the question is, can he deliver that? Can he actually bring back manufacturing and cool jobs? It's been 6 months. It's been 6 months, so it's hard to say, you know, what happens. But, I mean, that was sort of the motivation. And the question
but he's
is,
certainly not the
deliver?
First to promise to bring back jobs
no,
to the Mahoning
not.
Valley.
But, no, he's definitely not, and I'm sure he will not be the last. The thing is, that area and so much of Ohio and manufacturing areas, they're areas in transition. They are places where they want to build things, but maybe it's not sort of the nuts and bolts. Maybe it's a little bit more high skilled. Dayton, I think, is a really good example of a place where they build. I jokingly call it the nerd economy, but they build really high tech sort of things. And I think that maybe the future, but it's a hard transition. It isn't easy, and it certainly isn't quick.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, you have people who are waiting for an opportunity who don't see one coming. And for them, Trump was an attractive option. Whether he still is, you know, that's to be seen, I guess. We'll see what happens during the midterms. That'll be the first indicator.
Linda in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you, Ann?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I want to return to the Jeff Sessions thing for a moment, if I can. To me, this is also transparently self-protection on the part of Donald Trump, because, you know, Jeff Sessions recused himself a long time ago, soon after he was appointed Attorney General, and then all of a sudden, this is a big problem for Donald Trump. And to me, it's just so transparent that he wants to fire him. He wants to get rid of him so that he can bring in another attorney general that will be more favorable toward him and get rid of Mueller and therefore stop this Russian investigation.
Yeah, well, you know, what about the timing of all of this, Jessica Wehrman? Is there anything concrete to link it to, where he suddenly ticked off about the recusal? Because it did happen very early on. And also, I'm not sure Sessions had much of a choice when it came to recusing himself.
I don't know that he did either. I think he was irritated because he didn't give him a heads up. Not that I think he would have wanted him to recuse himself.
I don't think he thought about that he was going to be doing that.
But the drumbeat, I have to say, has gotten a lot louder as the Mueller independent counsel stuff has heated up. I don't think that's coincidental.
Okay. Linda, thanks a lot for that call. Okay, what is going on with transgenders in the military, Jessica Wehrman? This just popped up on my screen today. The president
it was
wants
a new headline every
yeah,
day.
it was the new headline today. I didn't have a chance to even read about it because I was so busy preparing, but what's going on?
All right. So, in the last administration, the Obama administration began a review of transgenders in the military. A couple of things have happened since then. Defense Secretary Mattis has delayed that transition to sort of figuring out how to, you know, make sure that folks could serve, regardless of whether they were transgender or not. And last week or the week before, the House actually, and House Republicans, blocked a measure that would have set, let me make sure I'm kind of explaining this right. There was a Republican congresswoman who wanted to block the Defense Department for paying for medical care for transgenders, meaning the Defense Department's not paying for your transition. The House did not back that. Basically, they said, "Nope, we can still pay for your transition." So that's sort of the political layup of this. And then today, he sent out several tweets saying, "You cannot serve in the military," and by he I mean Donald Trump, saying, "You cannot serve in the military if you are transgender." Now, a couple of things to point out here. There's an estimated between 1,000 and 6,000 people serving in the military today who are transgender. Under what Trump said today, and I haven't seen the executive order to match, they would not be able to serve. Transgender does not, and I'm getting this from a Rand Institute study on this, transgender doesn't necessarily mean you're actually transitioning. It just means you identify as another gender.
Right.
So not all up to 6,000 are going to ask the military to pay for them to transition to a new gender. The military concerns about this have to do with unit cohesion and possibly the cost of this. But this was sort of a new rub on it. But I think it was basically sort of meant to kind of address the House shooting down the idea of the Defense Department and the federal government paying for transgender people transitioning in the military. I also want to add that President Trump did campaign about being very open and inclusive to lesbian, bisexuals, gays, and transsexuals, including he actually mentioned them in his speech accepting the nomination for the presidency.
What I'm unclear about with this, and I guess I will be educated on it, is how that policy shift can actually take hold. Mm-hmm. Is it something that can be done by executive order? Does it take congressional legislation? Is it something that is better left to the military itself? I just don't know the answer to that, and I guess we'll find out the answer over time.
I believe it's an executive order. I mean, I guess before Ash Carter, you know, announces creation in July 2015 to create this working group to study, you know, welcoming transgender people to open servingly, the policy before that was, you know, it was basically kind of disqualifying, but people still served. They just didn't really, it wasn't really discussed. I mean, they just didn't weigh in on this until Ash Carter really weighed in, and now the Trump administration is sort of reversing that transition to allowing transgender people to serve.
And I should add that what I'm uncertain about is that there can be executive orders, and the Trump administration or Trump has issued a number of them. Mm-hmm. Some of them have no force.
Yeah.
Are just symbolic. Some of them have real force, and they do indeed change policies. And I don't know which one this is, but maybe we'll find out.
Jessica Wehrman, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time as always.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Wehrman, Columbus Dispatch, Washington correspondent, and Paul Beck, a political scientist at OSU. Thanks to you as well. I always appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann, and good to talk to you, Jessica.
Thanks to everybody else for your calls. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.